Anchorage School Board needs to pass a balanced budget by March 1st. With nearly flat funding from the state, the district is facing a $48 million shortfall. That could mean cutting jobs, increasing the student-to-teacher ratio, and closing an elementary school. But the budget process isn't over yet. Today on Hometown Alaska, we're talking about the school district budget, how it's determined, and how the school board works and more. I'm your host, Ann Hillman. Our guests today are Anchorage School Board member Carl Jacobs and Anchorage School District Chief Financial Officer Andy Ratliff. Thanks very much for being here. And due to the snow, they're both joining us over Zoom. We'd also love for listeners to join the conversation. What questions do you have? What are your thoughts on the process? Call us at 907-550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752 statewide. You can also email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Andy and Carl, thanks very much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Morning.
So I think probably the key thing on a lot of people's mind is that there's a lot more snow outside. And it's the first remote learning school day because of snow this year. How's it going?
So far, we haven't heard a lot of many complaints, but as a parent personally, you know, I have three kids in the school district, and both of my younger ones got packets sent home from their elementary school to be able to work from home just in case this did happen. So they were prepared to have work available, and then teachers have sent out links so they could have Zoom classes with them too. And then I think my oldest is expected to do his work remotely on just online platforms.
And I have
parents seem to be going good.
Yeah, and I'll join Andy in saying that as a parent of two teenagers who are upstairs on Zoom and engaging in online learning, I think it's an adjustment and something that we're going back to, a skill that we've built up over the last couple of years for sure.
Are you all concerned at all about like snow plowing and having to have more remote days like this?
I can jump in and say, you know, I think this is the eighth day the school district has had that's been considered a snow day this year. I think that our staff and our parents and our students would all rather be in person. Obviously, the municipality's had some challenges, and the school district is doing what it can from my perspective to be a good partner and to make sure we're accomplishing our core mission of educating students for life and career success.
Yeah, it seems like you already had a pretty solid backup plan in place just in case.
It's the goal is to be flexible. And I guess I can't go without saying that our educators and support staff, our education professionals are really the rock stars making that happen. The work that they do every day is amazing. And the flexibility that we ask them to demonstrate is challenging. It's been a very hard year for them, and I want to acknowledge their service as well.
Thank you. Thank you for that. So the main thing that brings us here today is talking budget, because the board will be voting on the budget on the 21st, so coming up. I'd really like to start at the very, very beginning and with the very basics, and I'd love to hear what each of your roles are in developing the budget. So Andy, you're the CFO. What exactly do you do?
Well, I started being the CFO on the beginning of January, so up until that point, I was the senior director of the Office of Management and Budget, so I do have and maintain a role in creating the district's budget overall. So, so the budget office is me and three other budget analysts, and we're the ones responsible for putting the entire budget together. So I have a really in-depth, that really is what I've been doing for the last several years, is putting this budget together. So I do have a good understanding of what goes into it. So, and I've done most aspects of it, so.
Okay. So what does go into it? Like, people think teachers, people think school buildings. Like, what all goes into a school budget?
So a lot of things go into it. I mean, the first steps are we identify how many kids we think we're going to have come back next year. And then from there, we can start determining how much revenue we think we're going to get. That's the biggest thing, is we know we really just have to have a balanced budget. So we have to know how much money we think we'll have. And that really starts, you know, the student counts by school, our projections. So we project out how many students we think we're going to have at grade level, and then turn that into dollars based on the state statutes that are in place through our state's foundation formula. So after that, we determine how much money we have, and then we just determine our first step really is, if we're going to do things the same way as we're doing them currently, how much is that going to cost? And we call that a pro forma budget. So we assign, here's how many teachers that would take at each building, how many nurses, counselors, principals, librarians, all the different support that goes into each building, and then get a cost of how much it's going to cost to do things the same way. And we really kind of, we call that our pro forma budget, and we release that in December. If you go out on the district's website, we do have that listed, and you can kind of tell the, and you can see the assumptions that go into determining how much everything is going to cost. So the difference between how much money we have through the revenue and how much that cost is going to be is really when we start developing a budget deficit. But by and large, when we're developing these school budgets, it's really, most of it's metrics based. We say, here's how many kids at grade level in each school. Here's how many teachers would be assigned to that based on the pupil teacher ratios. And then we have different metrics for other staffing positions at the school level. We're projecting out utilities, insurance costs, all those different things that are going to affect how much money we have to spend.
Okay. So you look at projected budgets based on this year, based on the number of students you think you're going to have. Where does the school board come into this, Carl?
Yeah, that's a great question. So as Mr. Ratliff and his team develop that pro forma, the board is engaged to review that document and have conversations both with as a board and with the community as to what our values are, what we want to prioritize, and how we balance our budget, which is a statutory obligation. I think that the difference this year is that we knew a fiscal cliff was coming based on a flat funding from the state and a base student allocation, which hasn't been adjusted for inflation. Now in the same per student that we were on the first day of school in 2016. And so the district and the board were pretty intentional about working together to engage the community early on. And we started this budget as early as fall, really trying to get a gauge as to how our community wants us to prioritize the limited funds that are available. And so we're now engaged in the budget work that will be the fruit of that effort, and we'll be passing budget on the 21st tentatively at our next board meeting.
So Carl, you cut out a little bit, so I just want to make sure that listeners understood that the base student allocation hasn't changed since 2016. So you knew you had a fiscal cliff coming.
Yep, correct, Anne. Yep. And so the Anchorage school districts, like other state districts across Alaska, are receiving the same base student allocation figure per student as we were on the first day of school in August of 2016. And so I think that's why you're seeing districts across Alaska, from Mat-Su down to Juneau, grappling with budget deficits and also speaking with one voice that we're asking Juneau to address the stagnant education funding. And I'm thrilled that leaders in Juneau are talking about it right now and taking that issue up.
Are you optimistic that it will change?
I tend to be an optimist by nature. I see, this is the first half of the legislative session, and to see Senate Education taking up the issue right away, prioritizing Senate Bill 52, which would potentially increase the BSA by $1,000, and having public testimony just weeks after session starting, that shows to me that our leaders in Juneau are taking this matter seriously, and hearing from districts across Alaska with the same challenges, I think, is driving that point home. And so as a board member, I'm focused on how we can use our funds accountably and making sure we're holding our end of the bargain up to give the legislature confidence that once we are awarded additional funding, which is critical for our operations, that that'll be used wisely in the best interest of students.
So $1,000 base student allocation, what if that increase happens, what would that look like for the Anchorage School District? Like, how much more money are?
So that would generate roughly $73 million in new state money for the district. And that's just based on the statutory formula where we take our average daily membership, which is our student count, and then it rolls through a series of adjustments to get an adjusted average daily membership. And that's about the adjusted average. It starts at about 44,000 or so students for the average daily membership, which is our student count, essentially. And then once it rolls through these different steps in this foundation formula, it gets to about 73,000 for Anchorage. So it's really the 73,000 adjusted average daily membership times the whatever the BSA, the $1,000 that's proposed. That's really how we calculate the new state money. But there is like the other piece of that too, is there is a local match where the local government can also kick in a little more money. Right now they're limited. The state does limit how much the city can collect for education. So this would increase that limit, but by the time it gets done, I suspect our tax notices will already be done and we won't be able to collect it. And we have a city upper tax cap too that would further limit that. But 73 million is a really big, would be a nice increase for that, for education. So
73 million would close what you all are looking at as your current budget shortfall.
Yes, for sure. It would be a great help. And that'd be allow us to add some of the things back and or put money back in savings, because our budget this for next year is really heavily reliant on the use of our savings accounts.
Okay. So all of the things that the legislature might do are hypothetical. So let's look at what this current budget that you've put together includes. Because it theoretically has a $48 million shortfall. So what did that mean you all looked at closing or cutting? Sorry.
We didn't make a whole lot of structural changes to the budget. The biggest piece was the increase in the pupil teacher ratio, or the amount of students in every class, kind of on average. It's not really a class size, but we did increase that by one pupil in every class on average. And that comes out to about, you know, we saved about $7.5 million there, and it was about 62 teaching FTE that helped close that gap.
So
to help close the gap, we did use a significant amount of fund balance, about $45 million of our savings, that really draws us down to the board minimum that we can carry forward. And then we're using another about $20 million in remaining federal stimulus funds from the ARP Act, which expires at the end of next year. So
I'm sorry, from the what?
About $65 million in one-time money that is supporting this budget to make limited structural changes to our education system.
Okay. Carl.
I can add that from the board member's perspective, what we focused on is trying to work with administration to identify efficiencies as well. The proposed budget does decrease district administration and operation costs, as well as potentially offer efficiencies with the ASD virtual program. Andy did discuss the PTR increase as well. And so I think that there were savings that we found. For better or for worse, the district has continued to reduce expenses and find efficiencies due to inflation eating away at our spending power since effectively 2016. And so that's getting harder and harder to do every year.
PTR is pupil teacher ratio. Okay.
Yeah.
And when you say that you're looking at making things more efficient and cutting down administrative costs, like, what does that look like exactly? And how does that impact teachers? Because, I mean, teachers aren't the only ones who are interacting with students.
Right. And we speak about some of the administrative costs. It would be generally just the folks working in the ed center, kind of behind the scenes, not directly with students. We did like restructure our ASD virtual program. So we were able to eliminate some staff there. We eliminated a supervisor of our gifted department. Some of the other unfilled, like just vacancies within there. There wasn't a whole lot of structural change that should affect what they're doing at schools, but you know, potential of processing times to take a little bit longer.
Okay. Could it affect the amount of support teachers are receiving outside of school or outside of the classroom?
The cuts that we made this year, I don't believe a lot of them will affect the support they're getting. I think they'll continue to see a similar level of support from the administration, but we're just trying to find efficiencies and reduce some of the positions that have been vacant or just no longer needed. You know, just trying to really be frugal with the district's money and not have stuff that's really not completely necessary.
And I think that was the goal that the board prioritized in listening to our community and kind of being that conduit for public input was we heard loud and clear from the public that we needed to prioritize classroom operations. And so that was the goal of this budget, which did result in us using a significant influx of savings, one-time funds, and then working to identify other efficiencies. The part that makes me nervous as a board member is if flat funding does continue, some of those cuts may not be avoidable. And so that's why I'm thrilled that our leaders in Juneau are taking up the issue. And I'm proud to be working with my other board members to advocate with our elected officials to address this issue this session.
And you mentioned community input. I do want to remind listeners, we are taking calls and emails right now. You can join us live on air at 907-550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752. You can also email hometown@alaskapublic.org. So, Carl, you mentioned that as board members, it was your job to really interact with the community and find out their priorities. Can you tell me a little bit more about kind of the specifics that you heard outside of just really prioritizing operations in the classroom?
Sure. I think that we through the number of town halls that were had, through the our public forum and our board meetings, through email correspondence, through attending community councils, I think that we heard a justified focus on making sure that we're, one, being accountable as a board and as a district. And then there was a big focus on literacy and reading, which aligns with our board goals. The board's adopted significant and measurable goals related to the reading and math proficiency, as well as making sure our students are college, career, and life ready. And to do that, we have to put those resources into the classroom. And so I think it speaks to the importance of long-term sustainable education funding, and so that's what we're working with administration to prioritize, and we're trying to be accountable by measuring those goals at each of our board meetings, and we're hoping to demonstrate that accountability to the public, and so that's kind of what I've heard is we need to be engaged, we need to work together because there's too much at stake for our students.
Okay, and you've both mentioned the pupil to teacher ratio a couple times. What does that mean exactly if you increase it by one? Does that just mean one more child in each classroom?
That is the average, yeah. So it would be, and it doesn't mean that for each classroom. It's really just that net metric to determine the number of teachers at each school. So you're always going to have classes that are going to be above and below that, but that's just really the average amount that we're going to budget on. So you might have a PE class at a high school with 50 kids in it, and you might have an AP English class with 20 or something. So those are all, it's not going to be that amount of kids in each class, but it is just that average metric.
And how does the district stand right now with that metric as in relation to recommendations from
currently the metric, and it starts at kindergarten at 22 pupils to teachers in the classroom, and then it goes up to about 31.25 in secondary schools. So that's really kind of what we're trying to get as the average, but again, it's not necessarily exact.
Okay, and then for people who haven't been in a classroom recently, you talk a lot about classroom resources and making sure that that's what we're really focused on. What does that include beyond, teachers with books and teaching materials?
So within a school building, there's a lot of different costs we would assign. It is the other staff, the principals, nurses, counselors, librarians, all the specialists that they have. So we have the classroom teachers, then we have art, health, music, PE, all these kind of other specials that the kids get to go to. So we have those. And then within there too is we have like special education costs. That's been increasing significantly over the last several years just due to higher needs. Like we have more students with intensive needs than we had years ago. So that continues to increase. And if you look at our budget for next year, you'll continue to see that where we put more resources into our special education systems for our students, and as well as mental health too. So we did stand up a mental health department this year to try to address some of the increasing mental health issues we've been having as kids have returned from pandemic.
What does the new mental health department look like?
So they have a little over 18 staff, and it's going to be counselors and behavior analysts and specialists that go and get pushed out to schools to help alleviate some, or assist with some of the behavior problems they're seeing. You know, that's really the high level of it. If you want more specific, so I'd probably have to get back with you with someone who's more of an expert in exactly what services they'll be providing.
I totally understand. Mental health is very complicated. Carl, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'll add in that because the board can only do so much in regard to allocating resources, we've tried to work with administration to identify other ways to improve student outcomes. And that has included allocating funds to mental health professionals and making sure our school counselors are supported. And in turn, they are supporting our educators. It also looks like a recent board policy that passed, which will guarantee all students in the district for the first time a minimum lunch period that won't begin until after their meal is served, because the science says that students that have adequate time to eat will not only have better health outcomes, both physically and mentally, but there's also data that points to improved student achievement. And so it's things like that that I think the board can partner with administration on while we wait for our leaders in Juneau to address some of the more foundational elements that will help students succeed.
That's kind of an amazing small piece of science there, that just having an adequate amount of time to eat really improves students. Yeah,
it's a great partnership that we're working with staff from Merrimack College and Harvard on. The data is truly impressive. I know that a number of our board members were taken aback by how much difference it could make. And the board policy actually just passed unanimously at our last meeting. And so was really excited for that. And I'm looking forward to seeing how those changes are implemented as soon as next school year.
And so how long will each student have to eat?
Yep. So at the elementary level, it starts as at a guaranteed 20-minute period that will begin again after students receive their meal. As a therapeutic foster parent to, I think, between 50 and 60 youth, I can't tell you the number of times, unfortunately, I heard the students had 5 or 10 minutes to eat because they were the last student in the lunch line. And so it was definitely a passion of mine, as well as other board members. I was privileged to chair a committee to update our policy with member lessons and working together with experts, parents, health professionals, and community members to achieve a common goal, and being able to partner with administration, I think was a great win, not just for the district, but for students as well.
Excellent. We are going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more conversation with the Anchorage School District.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. For more information about this episode, visit us online at alaskapublic.org.
The conversations you hear on Hometown Alaska are focused on the needs and voices of Alaskans, and the generosity of Alaskans brings them to you. Join your neighbors and become a member of your public radio station today.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska on KSKA 91.1 FM. Today, we're talking with Anchorage School District CFO Andy Ratliff and school board member Carl Jacobs, and we're taking your calls and emails. What questions do you have about our local schools? What are your thoughts on the budget? Join us by calling 907-550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-8433. 5752 statewide. You can also email hometown@alaskapublic.org. We did have someone who called in and left a message asking a question basically about what is the district and what is the school board doing to make sure that all young people, especially underprivileged or at-risk young people, are protected from these cuts and make sure that they're not more impacted by other students.
I can chime in. I mean, I'll let Andy see chime in as well. I think that the board is very mindful of making sure that we're monitoring closely outcomes of all student groups, and that includes, you know, when we do our goal monitoring at every meeting and perform that work, there is a subgroup specifically for economically disadvantaged students, and I think that we're poring over that data and finding ways to support students regardless of their backgrounds. As a therapeutic foster parent, I know firsthand that not every student comes to school in a place that they're ready to learn and ready to operate without significant support, and which is why the work that our educators and support staff are doing is critical. And that's why things like adequate lunchtime and adequate mental health supports for our students are absolutely necessary. You know, we do have some assistance, which maybe Andy can speak to, you know, from the federal title programs, but really it's being intentional and making sure that we're giving space to those conversations and engaging the community and listening as to how we can better support families, as well as, I think, is a big piece of it. And so being accessible and then being accountable to those conversations, I think, is a big start.
Right. And I would add to it, as regards to the title funds, we do receive Title I that is directed towards lower income students or schools with a higher population of lower income students. And other things we're trying to do as we closed Abbott Loop, which was a Title I school, transitioning those resources over to the school, the receiving schools, and making sure those students, and before they were a, what we call a CEP school, which is a community eligibility provision in the for food service, so that all the whole entire school would get free lunches. So what we're trying to do is make sure that those students can still eat for free as they transition into their new students, to be able to help support them in that move.
So you mentioned closing Abbott Loop Elementary. Can you talk a little bit about the process of why that school is going to close and what that means for those students?
Sure. So that school was in, we slated, I think we proposed 6 schools for closure for this year, and really just based on the condition of the facility and then the ability for surrounding schools to receive those students, so you wouldn't have to bus them as far. So Abbott Loop really fit those criteria. It's one of our oldest or in need of the most work school. And we ended up just choosing that one to close. And most of the students are going to go to Cassoon Elementary, and a handful will go to Trailside Elementary. But it's really predominantly driven by the condition of the building and then the population of where the receiving students can go.
And in closing that school, how much money does the district save?
So initially the district would save, I think, a little under $1 million or so, just from the personnel, like the teachers and the supply money, that will all follow the students. But then you save the cost of the principal, custodians, librarian, nurses, these ones where we have like one per school, and then all the utility costs and things like that. So it's, we do save money when we close those. There is a provision in state statute that talks about how much money we actually receive, and it's based on the size of a school. So when we close a school, eventually we're going to lose money, lose revenue, because the other schools are now larger. Because it's kind of a sliding scale where we get more money per student for smaller schools. So at the end, and there's a hold harmless provision where they'll step that amount of revenue loss down over 5 years. So in the first year, we save a little under $1 million. Then by the time we get down to the fifth year, it's about a cost neutral proposition. So, but then you don't have the facility, the capital needs of that facility.
So then what happens to that facility?
This one, we're still undetermined. There's a few things that could happen to, you know, not just Abbott Loop, but any facility that's closed. The district doesn't actually own any property. It's all owned by the city. We just have management rights of it. So if we determine that a building is in excess and we don't need it, then we would cede that back to the city, and it's ultimately up to them to do what they wish with the property. We can make recommendations and work with them, or we could turn it over to a charter school. That's the other option. If the facility's in a reasonable enough shape, we can turn it over to a charter school that's leasing space currently, and they can save money on their lease costs and then have upkeep on the building.
Okay. Are there any charter schools that are looking for homes at the moment?
Carl,
so, at a recent board meeting, and the board heard from the policy committee of Alaska Native Cultural Charter School. Right now, they are based in a wing of Betty Davis East Anchorage High, due to damage to their former primary structure, and there was some interest indicating that they view Abbott Loop Elementary as an option. Obviously, the district's first priority at this point is to prioritize the transition for families of Abbott Loop to their new academic homes. And so I don't think the board's taken that up at this point fully yet, but I think we'll wait for a recommendation from administration. I imagine those conversations are ongoing, but we're prioritizing, you know, Abbott Loop Elementary students first.
And during the conversation around closing schools, you mentioned, I think, that there were six originally listed. Is it still possible that other schools will close in the future, given changing numbers of students?
So the conversations that the board has had and briefings from administration seem to indicate that the district is looking at other places that we can save money, such as renegotiating healthcare, consolidating schools, and repurposing buildings for childcare, preschools, and other programs, which you know, would be of need and then would benefit young people for years to come. I think all options are on the table as long as we're using our North Star of what's best for students, given our current fiscal picture. And that's obviously the challenge that we're working through. You know, Alaska puts roughly 10% less investment into education than any other system in the nation. And, you know, a study put out by the UAA Institute of Social and Economic Research has indicated we're spending below the national average on education funding. And so all those things kind of lay out the playing field, if you will, for how we're making the best decisions we can for students.
Given that data that the state is spending less on education than most other places, What would you recommend the community do at this point? Like, what can they do to change that?
It's a great time to get involved, and there's a couple different ways to do that. Obviously, every person here in the Anchorage area has a House representative and a senator, and our Anchorage delegation is or some of the folks leading the charge to increase education funding. Senator Loki Tobin is the chair of the Education Committee. There is a bill, Senate Bill 52, which is in that committee right now, which would substantially address the base student allocation and potentially change the course of public education funding in Alaska. I think that advocating for sustainable and predictable funding is key. Mr. Ratliff's position and role is not an easy one, and that he's asked to develop a budget based on what may happen in Juneau. And there's local implications for that too. Because we've been flat funded through the base student allocation since the first day of school in 2016, it also affects local property taxpayers too, based on rising home prices in the Anchorage area. Roughly $16 million of the state's obligation is shifted onto local property taxpayers. So there is a vested interest for everyone to chime in and let their elected officials know that they value public education and that this is the time to address it. Obviously, our board meetings are always welcome. We have two of those a month. There is an hour for public testimony. And legislators hear from us often. We often hear that they would like to hear from their constituents more. So there is a legislative priorities website webpage on the ASD website, and you can get in contact with your local elected officials there and find out who represents you on that site.
And what are some of the other legislative priorities beyond the BSA?
Sure. So I think that the other two would be addressing student transportation funding, and then I believe the third is regarding bond debt. There is currently a school bond debt moratorium, which means that property bonds that are passed are 100% local funded, and that is another challenge that we're navigating as a district and as a board. We did pass approve a bond proposition to go to the Anchorage Assembly, and that did pass their body as well, so that will be on the ballot this upcoming April. But having state support and maintaining our infrastructure here locally would be a big help. And so advocating for adequate funding for student transport, as well as the infrastructure that we need to make sure our students are warm, safe, and ready to learn would be great.
Andy, do you have anything to add?
No, I just echo his comments. You know, we're really pushing for transportation. It's another one of those issues that have been identified, really hasn't been funded, and that amount hasn't changed. It's a per student amount, but it hasn't changed since 2015-16. So we still receive the same $481 per student that we received back then. And we've had to put more money from either the general fund or increase tax levies to be able to help shore that up. So that is a priority for us, and that's hurting all districts. Especially as you've watched, you know, not being able to fill all our bus routes because we've tried to keep wages artificially low for the last several years because we weren't getting new state money. But to be able to fill those bus routes this year, and now we've got them all filled, it took, you know, a 20 or 25% wage increase or base wage rate increase for those drivers just to get people in the door to apply for the job.
That's a pretty significant factor. And so when you're budgeting for next year, you're keeping that wage increase for drivers in place?
Yeah, correct. And that's gone through the contractual agreement with the union too. So,
okay. I remember years ago during budget conversations, because it was unclear how much was coming from the legislature, that the district had to issue pink slips to teachers that then they, I guess, rescinded. I'm not quite sure if that's the right word. Is that something that is at risk of happening again?
It's a good question. I think you're referencing probably back in 2017 or 18 was the last time that we had done this. And that was, I believe, the first year of Mr. Dunleavy's governorship, where they came and they proposed, and the state was running out of money, and they proposed some really significant cuts that year to the tune of like hundreds of millions of dollars to education. So in try to preparation for that, the district did issue some pink slips. We were able to hire everyone back that year, and I don't anticipate this year having to issue pink slips. Really, the change in the number of teachers we're expecting, coupled with how many vacancies we have and how much turnover we expect, you know, we're going to have jobs for the folks that want them.
Is the district having any trouble recruiting for positions, teaching positions?
Oh, absolutely. That's been one of the hardest things, and kind of goes back to the topic with the bus drivers, where we had to raise their rates to be able to get them in the door. But there's a nationwide shortage of teachers, and particularly specialists within special education, that we haven't been able to fill. And it's just not being competitive and not enough of them nationwide to be able to fill those slots. So we do anticipate having a significant amount of vacancies going forward too.
And I think what as board members we've heard from the community is Alaska workforce development is an issue right now across various sectors. ASD needs to be a partner in that conversation as we're producing the next generation of our workforce. And so, you know, it's one of the reasons why the board's prioritized graduating students that are college, career, and life ready. To that end, the board just recently saw one of its interim goals come to fruition, that students in select schools are now receiving financial literacy curriculum as a part of economics class. And so it's little things like that that we're trying to do to make sure that we're fulfilling our obligation to get those graduates ready to take on some of those next, some of those roles after they leave, whether that be college or through a trade or something in between. There's a huge need for education professionals. I think part of the challenge there is it's right now Alaska is the only state where a education professional doesn't receive either full Social Security benefits or a pension. And that's another issue that Juneau is grappling with right now. We are experiencing, a challenge in recruiting and retaining staff. But when there's fiscal reasons for someone to take their talents elsewhere, whether that be either in or outside of Alaska, that's something that we need to partner with Juneau to address.
All right. Sounds like a lot of conversations need to be had between a lot of districts in Juneau. We are going to take another quick break, and then we'll be back with more conversation around Anchorage School District.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA 91.1 FM. And today we're talking with Anchorage School District CFO Andy Ratliff and School Board Member Carl Jacobs. We have about 15 minutes left, more time for your calls and questions. You can reach us at 907-550-8433. You can also call statewide at 1-888-353-5752. And the email's open, hometown@alaskapublic.org. So we've talked a lot about the budget. We've talked a lot about politics. I want to make sure that we have a little bit of time to talk about some city issues, just because municipal elections are coming up soon. And I did a lot of work around elections last fall. And what kind of became pretty obvious was some people don't go to the polls because they're not quite sure what different elected officials do. So, Carl, I was wondering if you could kind of give us an overview of what exactly you do as a school board member and what that role entails.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I ran for the school board because I was a community member who valued our public education system, who served as in my career as someone who's protected the vulnerable Alaskans across our state. And I wanted to get more involved. And so, the long and short of it is the Anchorage School Board is a 7-member body that doesn't have districts like our assembly people or local legislators. We do represent the entire municipality, which I think adds value as we're not advocating just for some students, but we're constantly looking out for every student the district serves and every one of the 40,000 plus students learning every day. Our roles are largely a governance board. So we're making and passing policy. We are reviewing financials, passing budgets, and being fiscally responsible to the resources that were entrusted, both from the federal government, from the state, and from the local municipality. And then we're also the conduit for public opinion. We're out there engaging the public through attending local community council meetings, attending community events, being accessible via email and otherwise, and making sure that the voices of our stakeholders are heard and that we're acting based on what we're hearing. And so it's a complex role that's very challenging. It technically isn't a full-time job, but I think most board members this year would tell you it, practically speaking, that isn't necessarily the case. And so, but it is an honor. And it's been a privilege to serve in the role here for about 2 years now.
And It's not a full-time job, but is it a job? Are you paid to do this, or is this just full-on volunteer?
Yep. So the there is a commission within the municipality that sets salaries for both assembly members and school board members. We are compensated, and that gets adjusted and controlled by the city and that specific commission that's appointed by the mayor, I believe.
Okay. And so what sorts of skills does it take to sit on the school board?
You know, the minimum qualifications, the list isn't very long. If you were to look at the ballot package and the applicant package, with that said, I think there's value in having a variety of perspectives. Currently on our board, we have former educators, administrators. You have significant, an accomplished professionals. We have a historian and a doctor on our board. And so I think that the skills that make up a good board are folks who have the availability and the time to dedicate to the work, someone who is willing to both compromise as well as approach issues with an open mind, and then is willing to make those hard decisions. Obviously, the board's been grappling with some incredibly challenging work this year. When we're talking about school closures or combining campuses and declining state funding, those aren't issues that can be approached lightly. And it's a very challenging time for Anchorage area families and Alaska families in general with public education. And so, making space for that and being available and accessible, I think is huge.
So for the school board, like, what do those conversations look like? Are you making lists of pros and cons? Are you debating? Like, how do you get into such, emotionally challenging issues as well?
Sure. So I think all of the above, yes. So we have two board meetings a month. We have three committee meetings a month. And then outside of that, we each represent between 4 and 7 community councils where we're interacting directly with various sectors of the community that we volunteer to represent. We're taking all that feedback in and then discussing publicly, the best interests of ASD students and making the best choices that we can. I think there's so much at stake. And so all you can do is be intentional and make sure you're representing the will of your constituents and making sure that your students are and academic achievement is your North Star. So I think this board has done a great job putting students first and being accountable for those results.
Thank you. Thanks for talking about what the process is like. The other thing that's on this upcoming spring election ballot is another school bond. Andy, can you talk a little bit about what's in the school bond package this year?
Sure. Most of what's going to be on there is going to be safely. It's mostly safety related items. It's a little over $37 million in bond money, and it'll include safety improvements at Betty Davis East High School, roof replacements and structural upgrades at College Gate Elementary. Cassoon and Kincaid Elementary Schools will see repairs to their roofs. They were built back in the 90s, and they had this, there's a design flaw in them that makes them susceptible to leaking.
Oh.
And then we're going to have secure vestibules and security improvements at Birchwood, Bowman, Northwood, Ocean View, Spring Hill, and Trailside Elementary Schools.
What does that mean?
I thought I'd explain that too.
Thanks.
The secure vestibules it's the entryway into the school. So most schools, or the newer ones designed, have, they have the buttons where you can push it, and they have the camera to see to make sure you're, so that people can buzz you in. And also they have the office directly by that door. So the front office, who's got the safety, the buzzers and everything to contact the police, they're right there looking at the folks coming in. Some of the older buildings have those offices set back in the school a ways where they can't necessarily see the front door. So it's really just kind of redesigning the interior of the school to make it just a higher level of security.
Okay. And if the bond passes, would those improvements happen over the summer, ideally, potentially?
Probably not this summer. There's a lag between the time we need to we get the money or get approval to get the money, and then we have to go out to do all the bidding for the contractors and schedule all the work. So typically it's the summer after, and it may take a couple of years to complete all of it.
Okay. Anything else people should know about the bonds?
So ASD does have a dedicated webpage specifically for the 2023 bond proposition. It's asdk12.org/bond. And then if a member of the public ever had questions, you're free to reach out to school board members who can either get you the right information, or if they don't, connect you with a member of administration. And our email address is schoolboard@asdk12.org.
Right. And I would add to that, too, one of the other things is the bond package is a little under $38 million. Over the last 2 years, we paid off $110 million in our bond debt. So, you know, from over the last, you know, probably 15 years or so, the amount of debt we have outstanding has been declining as the district really hasn't asked for more bond money than what it's paid off. But that's, you know, got it's the other side of that, too, is we do now have a bigger backlog in what our facilities repairs that are actually needed.
Okay. How do you pay off the bond debt? Like, does that just come from, how do you pay off bond debt?
So there's a couple different things. Previous to 2015, when we had this, what they called school bond debt reimbursement from the state would pick up 60 to 70% of the cost of those bond payments. Since then, all the new propositions that have passed are 100% funded by the municipality, and that comes through property taxes. So it's just an additional property tax levy to pay off the bonds.
Okay. And so I think for this year, it would be like $8 or something per $100,000 value of a house.
And that's how much it would be for if the $38 million or so were sold right now. It would add about $8 per $100,000, yeah.
Okay.
But then we're also paying off more than that, so your actual tax bill for debt would go down a little bit.
Oh, because some of it's been paid off.
Right, yeah.
Okay. I will.
But it's really not a kind of a clean line because we don't sell it all at once either. We're not going to sell the entire $38 million at once. It's generally chunks based on when the work is performed in the future.
And I think the board and the administration have indicated a priority, at least until school bond debt reimbursement, like Andy spoke with, is back on the table, to be careful with the burden we're asking Anchorage area property tax owners to bear. And it's one of the reasons why we're advocating so heavily for our legislature to address it. We have a deferred maintenance backlog. I believe it's over $800 million. And so there's significant capital needs that we need to address. And Juno needs to be a partner in that process. And so more conversations need to happen.
What kind of things are included in the backlog?
So there's a lot of things in there. And it's based on a facility condition index. So if we have a boiler that's rated for 25 or 30 years, once it reaches that end of life stage, that's when it gets included in that backlog. The boiler probably still functions fine, but it is really nearing its end of life and needs replaced. So as we delay renewing some of these bigger components, and it's going to be roofs, boilers, other HVAC system type things, as those age out, they still work and we haven't replaced them yet, but they do need replaced. And that's really kind of that backlog that we describe.
And back earlier in the conversation when we were talking about school closures and potential school closures, you mentioned part of the reason Abbott Loop was chosen was because of some maintenance issues. So does that always play a factor? Will that play a factor later on if we once again get to a point of having to discuss a school closure?
Yeah, I believe absolutely the condition of the facilities would need to be a factor. But, you know, even if we have a school that's in poor condition, but we don't have anywhere to send the kids because the neighborhood schools are at capacity and that school is at capacity, then you don't have a whole lot of other options or options to put that one on the table. But it's really the combination of those two.
And
Carl, you're cutting out pretty heavily.
But ultimately, the district will, from my perspective, always take a course of action that's best for students. And so that might not be the cheapest route, but we have to make sure that students are in a great position to learn. That means having adequate facilities in the right location for the families that need to be served.
Mm-hmm. One of the other conversations that I know is ongoing is moving sixth graders into the middle schools. Can you talk a little bit about why?
Sure. Right now we have three or middle schools out of our 10 that are 6, 7, 8. And we'd like to move the ones that are currently 7, 8 to include the sixth graders. And it'll give more opportunities for those elective classes in the middle schools that they might not have in an elementary school. And also to be able to give some standardization on our curriculum and other instruction where right now, it's a little bit different at elementary and middle, depending on if you're a sixth grader in middle school, it's a little bit different than you're in a sixth grader at elementary school. So really to have that standardization and then have the opportunities for the students at those middle schools.
And like, what's the process look like for that and timeline look like for that at this point?
So the administration prepared, we're submitting a board memo. And we introduced it last week and it'll go for approval on the 21st. And we want to delay it and not implement it next year, but the following year. So that'd be FY 2024-25. But we want to have a good amount of time to plan and communicate it. And so we can really get those boundaries drawn right the first time, because we have to move kids from elementaries into the middle schools. And if we tried to piece it in or not do it all at once, you'd have these issues where you might end up reboundering families twice. And that just causes more confusion and angst among those families. We really want to try to limit that and only get it done once, but take a deliberative process and get it done, try to get it done right the first time.
Another important note is that this isn't a concept that's brand new to the Anchorage School District. Sixth graders are currently attending middle school in East Anchorage, for example. And so I think this is an opportunity to make our facilities consistent across the municipality, which I think has benefits in a number of different areas. We were just discussing potential benefits related to preparing students for Algebra 2 coursework that could be associated with the transition. And so it's, again, a case where we're trying to engage the community, listen, hear that feedback, and then take actions that are consistent with being best for students.
Are there situations now where some sixth graders will have been in elementary school for sixth grade, but then they go to a middle school where other students started earlier? Or not really?
So right now, I guess I don't understand.
I meant like some kids would be in the school earlier. Irrelevant. That is all of the time we have for today. Thank you very much. Our guests were from Anchorage School District. We had school district CFO Andy Ratliff and school board member Carl Jacobs. Our producer today is Ammon Swenson. Chris Hyde is the audio engineer. I'm your host, Ann Hillman. This is Hometown Alaska on KSK 91.1 FM, Alaska Public Media. Thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.